This episode was co-produced with Splint Invest, a regulated Swiss financial institution that helps private investors diversify their portfolio by providing easy access to alternative investments like art, luxury watches, and rare whiskey. With the Splint Invest app, you can start investing with as little as 50 Swiss francs. And in fact, Swisspreneur listeners can make their first investment for free by downloading the app and entering the promo code DOLLY24. Click the link in the description to learn more and redeem your investment voucher.
A lot of founders, they just want to raise the classic way. Then they think, yeah, you get a high valuation and then you get the buzz and then you're a success. But it's not how that works.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Anzuya.
Welcome, David, to the Swisspreneur podcast. So happy to have you here today with us.
Thank you for having me. It's fun to be on a podcast that I usually just listen to.
Yeah, and I'm sure our listeners will be very, very pleased to hear about your story. I had a good time preparing the call with you, so looking forward to this chat. So David is the co-founder and CMO at Quit, a platform for setting up a private employment relationship, as well as for startups with just a few clicks. David, we would like to get in by starting with your history, your personal background. So you studied physics and law at the University of Zurich. But already back then, you had your eye on the startup world. So in 2010, you participated in a venture challenge course at ETH. What excited you about entrepreneurship?
I think that was something that I had from really, really early on. Actually, in the beginning, I thought that it's normal that everybody wants to do his own thing. Because it's just more engaging if you also have the ownership. You see that, for example, if houses that architects build, the best ones are always those they use themselves. And I thought that's normal and everybody thinks like that. Over the time, I realized that it's not exactly like that, that there are some people that are rather have a fixed salary than the risk, but the upside of their own startup. And the more time passed by, I realized, maybe most people are not that entrepreneurial. And now I'm rather down to like 5% of all people that probably are entrepreneurial.
So did that change your attitude toward entrepreneurship when that bubble kind of bursted?
Not at all. I think it was good in the beginning to think that it's a bit, that it's normal, even though in comparison, it's maybe a bit more crazy, but I wouldn't value either of those. Both also have their advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah. So, I mean, you completed this challenge together with Daniel Moser, who was CTO at Quit until 2017. What were you two building back then? Like, how did this come about?
So we participated both in that venture challenge course, which took place at ETH Zurich. I think it still is taking place there. And everybody could show an idea. And the ones who got the most votes were the ones where you formed teams and where you played through the course with these ideas. And the idea there was eBay for services, so a matchmaking platform. And we also started out with that. That's why the company is still called Service Hunter, because the original product would have been called Service Hunter.
So how did it become Quit then?
We realized that these relationships that happened through that platform somehow would have to be legalized. Otherwise, it would be black work happening through our platform. So we thought, let's do an eBay for services with optimized legalization. But then we saw that for one, these are two different business fields. So matchmaking and these legalization, quote unquote. And we saw that many of them that tried to do a matchmaking platform didn't work out because you need a lot of money. You need the supply and the demand. And by the way, also, if you look now, there's still no eBay for services, even though many tried. Plus, there are two different fields of businesses. So we said, let's just focus on one for the beginning. And then we could still do the other part later.
So did you choose this idea of eBay for services because there didn't exist one? I mean, you're saying it there still already isn't one existing, really. So how did you even like narrow down on this idea?
I don't know how many back then already tried. Mm-hmm. But I saw many in Switzerland and also worldwide. I mean, there are some that you could say are in that direction, like TaskRabbit. Or I think in some countries, even eBay has like the services category. Mm-hmm. But in the end, I think it's just not something that people would use that often. You mm-hmm. don't have this many small one-time or ongoing tasks that aren't like a specific task, like cleaning or electrician that usually should be a professional.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that time, like you were also studying. So how... what were the challenges that you faced while, you know, thinking, okay, let's develop this idea further, and you're still in school, you know, personally also, like from what your parents thought, and financially as well, you need money to now start something. So how was it?
Now I'd say it wasn't that challenging from that perspective from that time on. So one thing, the financial part. So all my friends were still studying. So I lived in a flat together with six friends, and we lived on a really low budget. For example, I remember that it was forbidden to buy cheese because it was considered to be too expensive. It was a bit different for my co-founder, Daniel, who already finished his study and who was already working a full-time job. So he was already a bit used to earn some money, and then it's harder to... scaled back a bit. Mm-hmm. Then from a personal side, it didn't feel too much like a challenge, but one thing is for sure. So the thing you always hear about startups, that it's like a rolling coaster, that it's up mm-hmm. and down. And one day you're like, wow, this is $1 billion idea. The next day you're like, what am I actually doing here? This is totally normal. So in the beginning, especially through all the different phases, in the first phase, you don't have a product, you build up the product. Yeah. Then you might have a product, but you have to find customers. It's really always up and down.
Similar struggles, yeah, that everyone faces. But mm-hmm. I mean, you also told me that at that time, you also quit your education. And I mean, how did your family feel about that? And mm-hmm. also, what was their opinion about you like starting your own business?
They had a particular opinion about that. But first, I was like the eighth child of my parents combined. I only grew up with one real sister. But I think if you have many kids, you get more relaxed. So there was officially no pressure for school. So after primary school, I also went to the Realschule, Sek B, and then made my way up. But nevertheless, if there's no, let's say, official pressure, parents are really good at giving this rather unconscious, subtle pressure. Mm-hmm. And for them, education was really, really important, yeah. Like scientific nature, science, education. So my father definitely liked that I was studying, and when I said I quit my studies to start quit, he really didn't like it, and he said he believes that he will be, or I will be, disappointed later on. And then I asked him, do you think that I will be disappointed really in either case, or you think it's just that you are afraid that I would fail, and you say I'll be disappointed if I fail? And he said, no, I think you're going to be disappointed even if you succeed. And there I knew for myself that I hardly see any chance if I succeed that I will be disappointed.
But why do you think he said that?
I think for him, education is that important that he thinks if you miss out on
it's like you finishing physics, missed a big milestone of your life or something.
Yeah, but what I thought is like if I'm successful, I could still go back and study.
Yeah, of course.
Which I might do. So it's and then I thought I'd rather do it this way around than first finishing studies, because then it gets harder and harder. When you're young, it's easier to take the risk of founding a startup.
Mm-hmm. But how did it feel to you that then? Because, you know, your parents aren't fully on board. And just having, like you'd mentioned to me also before, that just knowing that you're not crazy and having support, like, helps a lot. So what was then your support system back then? Or did you need one, or you were just, like, too motivated to even care about it?
So two things. I think one part of education is the emancipation of it, so that you emancipate yourself from your parents. On the other hand, they didn't say, like, we forbid you to do it. It was more, again, this subtle pressure that they think something else would be a better idea, but that doesn't mean they didn't support me.
Okay.
And funny thing now, actually, my parents, I guess they're quite proud. So my father once said something like, oh, finally we have somebody in the family again who earns his own money.
that must have felt good.
yeah, for sure.
So in 2010, you and Daniel Moser founded Quit. Why was this particular interest in employee-employer relations and illegal work?
So it came out of that idea, I said, from that eBay of services. So I think it was never the main thing we're aiming at, was, or the main thing that we think about or the focus. It wasn't like the employee and employer relationship or the legal work. It was rather the service we provide to them. So the product. So we kind of have two users, the employers and the employees. And the employers are the one that are paying for the service. And from us, what we focus on is rather providing them a good service, and not. I think it's really good to have a business that does something useful, because even if you don't say this is like the number one you're always aiming at, the good you do, but it's just good to have that as a basis. I think through everything, for all people you talk to, for all employees and potential employees and partners, it makes everything way nicer if you do something good.
So just to understand a bit more, especially around the illegal work in Switzerland, right? So first question I would have is, what data do we have on illegal work in Switzerland to begin with?
So official, there's no data, because by definition, it's unregistered work, but we estimate it to be at between 30% and 60% that do not register their domestic helper. And worldwide, there are some numbers from the ELO, International Labour Organization, a sub-union of the EU, UN, and they count 75 million domestic helpers, which is quite a big chunk of the, like, people-wise of the global economy. And they expect that 80% of them are undeclared.
Yeah. I would even think that it would be even higher than what they're probably saying.
Could be. Yeah.
But, and why do you think that, you know, Swiss people employ cleaners, et cetera, in this manner? Is it like a matter of lack of empathy for others?
I don't think it's a lack of empathy. I think it's that people don't really think about it. Historically, it used to be a so-called Kavaliersdelikt, so something that everybody does and everybody thinks it's fine, so you don't worry about it anymore. And I also think that people from that generation will hardly change. If you think like that for, let's say, 40 years, you won't change your opinion. But in a younger generation, the opinion really changed. People realized that this double standard of how you are employed and how you employ just doesn't make sense. So imagine if you get the interview for a job as a teacher or a medical doctor, and then they'll tell you, yeah, but in the end, like, yeah, but we'll pay you cash and you won't have insurance and no pension. And by the way, you're not allowed to tell anybody you're working here. Like, nobody would accept that job. Mm-hmm. So all actually employers of domestic helpers have a job. They have all the three pillars of the Swiss retirement and social system. So they have Social Security, the first pillar. They have the pension fund, the second pillar. They have a third pillar, the 3R, and often even real estate. So it's just fair to at least have the first pillar for the person who washes your clothes and cleans your toilet.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, according to the Quid website, Quid charges a commission 600% lower than most cleaning companies. I mean, this is a huge difference, right? How on earth is it possible that cleaning companies are taking that big of a cut?
Mm-hmm. So first, as a disclaimer, I think you cannot one-on-one compare Quid to cleaning companies. So in cleaning companies, you buy the service. You actually buy the guarantee of the cleaned house in a certain quality level. And with us, you bring your own employee. Also, mm-hmm. when this person is sick, we don't bring you another person.
Mm-hmm.
But to explain that huge difference, so they take a high margin. They take a cut of 25% to 35%. And that already makes a way higher total sum.
Right.
And on top of that, they have to charge the value-added tax.
Mm-hmm.
And we take a commission not from the total amount, but from the gross wage. So just from the calculation number, we take 5% to 8%. And so even if cleaning companies would take zero commission instead of 25% to 35%, they would still be more expensive than us because they have to add the value added tax on the total sum.
So would you say that it is a benefit for them to go with the cleaning companies because maybe they can give them consistent customers? Or does that already happen as well with Quid?
I think as a cleaner, if you're good, it's not an issue to get customers.
That's
it's
true.
Rather hard to. So a lot of people, like some even don't want to give the contact number from their cleaner because they are afraid they will lose that person.
That's true.
So in Switzerland, I think that's not a topic. But for sure, if you are a full-time employment at one company is something different than having multiple different employers.
Mm-hmm.
But the characteristics of the models, how these people live and how many employment relationships they have is quite different. So mm-hmm. some do it in just for a certain amount of time. Some have a part-time job and have some private employers. So it's not like one way or the other. It's very...
Okay. So if you can also highlight some of the other benefits, because we found that employees on average are earning a 50% higher salary by working with Quid. So if you can elaborate a bit on that as well.
Mm-hmm. So for once, we do not set the salary. Huh? We are mm-hmm. not the employer, so our customers can define the salary completely their own. And the average salary of over 30 Swiss francs gross per hour shows that the employees are actually willing to pay a fair salary.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, the employees benefit in three additional areas.
Mm-hmm.
So one is what we provide them. So they also have a login where they can download documents, where they can add hours or expenses. We also provide a QR code, which you can scan and say, I work 2 hours. Then the mm-hmm. employer gets an SMS and can say, approve that. They can earn some money if they refer to us another customer. So small benefits like that. Then for sure, all the benefits we are used to or take for granted from the normal legal employment. So you're insured if you have an accident, if you get pregnant, if you get sick, you get a pension when you retire, and you have some protection of not being just fired mm-hmm. On one day. But one, the third one is probably the most hidden one, and I think it's a very, very strong one. So only 23% of all the employees on our platform are Swiss citizens. And imagine if you work illegal and you go in the morning, you go to work, and then the police stops you. Not that this is going to happen, but just imagine police stops you and ask you where you're going. Then you would have to lie. You would have to invent a story where you're going, what you're doing here, because you're not allowed to say you're going to work because it's unregistered work. And I think this constant state of kind of being illegal is for sure a subtle psychological pressure.
Yeah.
And if you're registered and if you pay your taxes, then you become a contributing member of the society. And especially since 80% have a migrant background discounts, I think that's a really probably one of the strongest positive effects.
No, that's really cool that they can have such a platform to help them out with this. So that's really good.
Yeah.
And how much does Quid cost for employers?
So in Switzerland, it's three different pricing models. Basic is for short-term relationships. That's 8% of the gross wage. Then there's Comfort, which is like the standard for a cleaner that comes every week. That's 120 francs per year plus 5% of the gross wage. And then for bigger employment, full-time nannies or so, it's a flat rate of 990.
Okay.
And in Germany, it's 6 euros per employee a month and 1 euro per declared hour.
Okay.
And with Quid Business, it's 19 francs per employee per month and 0.3% of the gross wage.
So let's talk also then about Quid Business. So you created another sort of for startups entity, Quid Business. So what was the purpose for that?
To leverage our technology that we had for private persons, to leverage that for smaller companies. So it's the same service as for private persons, but for smaller companies.
Mm-hmm.
Which there, that's even a bit more. It's kind of a combination between legal advice, insurance broker, trustee, the payrolling module of your bookkeeping software, and partially of your H, like takes over work of your HR person. The big prerequisite for becoming a customer is that you need to be a newly founded company that doesn't have an insurance or pension fund yet, because for our business model to work at such a low price, we need to have standardized and automatic processes. So we need contracts with the partners and we need electronic connections to them to declare everything automatically.
And do you also do that in Germany as well?
No, not yet. I think it would be a killer in Germany, a killer product, because Germany is, especially for companies, really complex. But for us, by the way, complexity is two-sided coin. So on one side, it's harder for us to do what we do.
Right.
On the other hand, it also gives us a stronger USP and protection about for competitors. We might do it in Germany in future, but right now Germany is only B2C, which is already complex enough. And it also took us in Switzerland a while till we opened up for businesses.
So, I mean, when and how did you decide to go, into the B2C German market as well?
Like 1.5 years ago. I always thought, why does everybody go to Germany? There are so many more countries out there in the world. Maybe Indonesia would be the biggest opportunity.
Okay.
So why doesn't everybody look at all countries? And why does everybody go to Germany? And actually, we looked at countries in Southeast Asia, which have really different setups. But somehow in each country, you could make something work, which is along our vision of fair employment. But yeah, in the end, we ended up going to Germany because geographical, language, culture, proximity are just really, really big factors, especially for the first country. Maybe if you've done a couple and then you want to add one more exotic one to test and prove if it also works in more exotic markets, then you would add one of those. But as the first one, yeah, I now understand why everybody's going to Germany.
So do you feel like it's closer to how things are done in Switzerland? Or was it like you went there thinking, oh, this would be rather not so difficult, but then you were setting up shop there and you realized, okay, the way that things are done here are actually very, very different.
In some cases, they're very, very different. Germany is really more bureaucratic, and some things feel kind of illogical. It's often only when you look abroad, I think in general, or when people from abroad come to Switzerland, when they realize how liberal Switzerland actually is. But compared, as I said, the other countries I looked at, for example, Singapore would have been interesting, but it's a total, total different system. So there, in this comparison, Germany is way, way more similar to Switzerland.
Okay.
This episode was brought to you by Google Cloud, a partner that needs no introduction. What you might not have heard of, though, is that Google offers a Google for Startups cloud program where they give you access to startup experts, technical training, business support, and cover your Google Cloud costs up to $200,000 for 2 years, or even $350,000 if you're an AI startup. Scale your startup faster and smarter with Google Cloud. Head over to goo.gle/Swisspreneur.
So Switzerland is known also as a deep tech nation. So as the founder of Qwit, have you ever felt prejudiced against, so to speak?
Deep tech nation. So what does deep tech even mean?
I mean, you have ETH here. You have all these, you know, biotech, robotics,
but like high tech, deep tech. No, so we actually profited from that. So we were an ETH spin-off, so we got cheap offices at Technopark. Went to Venture Challenge, won some money in Venture Kick. We got coaches from Cote, now InnoSwiss. So we were kind of in that system. But when I thought about why doesn't Switzerland have like these unicorns, let's say like Google, Facebook, X, Snap, Insta, Canva, Airbnb, TikTok, I realized that none of those, really none of those would have gotten any support from all these startup institutions because they always want deep tech. And I remember often, the thing is like support is one thing, that's not the game changer, I'd say, but this thinking also kind of trickles down to investors and they often also have the same strategy. If you're a tech guy, it makes sense that you only invest in tech because you know that that field. But I think a lot of investors kind of blindly just want tech. And back then it was all about patents. Like, oh, you don't have patents, no chance. And I mean, all these companies I just mentioned, now, yeah, they're tech companies, but back then they were kind of laughed at as low tech companies. Right. Like Google is just a search engine. I mean, there are many, everybody can do that.
Yeah.
Facebook, it's like the 100th social media platform. Like there's no tech in there.
Yeah. I mean, Amazon was just selling books and.
It's an online bookshop. Like there's nothing technical, exactly.
And so there were no prejudices, is what you're saying, or was there difficulties?
No, I see it just in other startups. And I think that this decision could make sense that you only focus on high tech because it sometimes makes sense, especially as a state, to focus on certain areas. And it is a bit of filter if you only look at ETH spin-off instead of every company that's founded in a whole country. But I think that often this strategic focus is not taken consciously.
Okay.
It's rather something, you just do as an investor. And the thing is, there's no guarantee that something that is MedTech is as risky as a social media platform.
For sure.
You can do trials on animals and 8 years later, something pops up and you hardly can use anything that you've done for the last 8 years.
Yeah, as you mentioned, it's also then about the thinking of the investors, you know, how do they evaluate and look at these different ideas and products or just companies. So there was also a period that I would like to talk about where you faced difficulties and disagreements with your co-founder, and you took some time off to, you know, recalibrate and rethink things. This was like basically in the end of 2016 when you quit and then returned in November 2019. So for over 2 years, like, what was that period like for you and what had happened?
Mm-hmm. So me and my co-founder didn't agree hardly on anything except one thing, that it might be better that we do not work together anymore. So I left operational business and went for a trip around the world. Actually started off from Zurich with my motorbike. The original plan was to get around the world without flying, which didn't work out in the end. I learned a couple of things. So for one, when you're operationally active, then you're at least 8 days of the day, you're like in the company, doing things, thinking about the company, and probably also even more in your free time. And you're involved in also a lot of details. Mm-hmm. But when you're in the jungle in Guatemala and don't have any reception for weeks, you cannot be involved in anything. And I think that disconnection and having to completely trust other persons in everything that happens in the company surely is a good exercise that probably, especially for founders, is a good learning for the long term.
So you learned to let go, basically, a bit more, you mm-hmm. could say. And then how did you decide, or what made you decide to come back?
So I came back and I was involved in other companies. Mm-hmm. I also saw how Quid changed a bit. One thing I realized, they were now, often I heard the sentence, yeah, we're not a startup anymore, we're now a KMU, which I kind of didn't like. Nothing against KMUs, but SMEs. But I think a startup is like about constant agile development and doing things the next year in a different way that you did it before. And there it was more like I saw a lot of documentation of processes. There were over 100 pages on design, for example. There was a documentation on how to define a persona for us. So not the persona for us, but on a middle level, on how to define that persona.
Right.
That you, and I think you hardly actually need a persona at all. Yeah, if you're completely gone, then also the company might change, take a different direction than you would have thought. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have that much control. But I came back actually a bit unplanned. So my co-founder already left for over a year. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for a person to do the marketing and growth, and sent me the job ad. And then I looked at it and was like, And I actually are still invested in the company. So I thought that's a big leverage I have there and a lot of motivation. And it was also really fun to get back because it wasn't already a bigger company, which is also a different structure. So in the beginning, you really can do everything, but you also have to do everything. Mm-hmm. And later you can more focus on the things that you really like.
Makes sense. So now in terms of what are your, let's say, main marketing channels that you employ for Quid?
Mainly it's search engine marketing.
Okay.
It was funny when we did the financing round, we hired somebody, a really good person who had 15 years experience in marketing, had a bachelor, master, MBA, led a marketing agency actually. And this person did a really good job in marketing, but just didn't touch anything online. So all classic marketing. Doing print stuff and so on. And then we somehow realized that these Google ads I'm doing as a small side hustle are like 100 or 1,000 times more efficient. Right. So that's when we realized that online marketing is the way to go. And it's still like that.
Still the way to go,
I mean,
yeah.
PR used to be something strong as well. Mm-hmm. Isn't with all the online media where you the articles constantly change, the impact isn't that big anymore. And I mean, then you can do the classic SaaS stuff, mm-hmm. like referrals will happen anyway, but if you have a referral program, you can push those a little bit more. All the optimizations along the complete customer journey.
Okay. You had mentioned that, you know, state institutions have no interest in efficiency. So we want to get it a bit into that as well. How is this a challenge in terms of digitalization?
Mm-hmm. We first thought, because a coach told us, it's not a challenge, that it's going to really help us. So he said, they will pay you because they need good data quality and they have a lot of overhead to clean their data. So we thought they will pay us, but as it turned out, that's not the case. And they are also not really interested in changing their processes. Mm-hmm. So for example, we have digital data and they also need digital data in the end. So you could send them digitally, one might think. But how it then actually happens is that we generate automatically a PDF and send it out automatically via email. They receive that email. They generate a PDF out of the email and the attached PDF. They then print it out and send it to the scan center where it is scanned in again. And then somebody types it off to again have digital data. Because that's the process they have set up and they're not really willing to change that.
Wow. that's all I can say about this process.
I hope it's not that much the case anymore. And we also now work together with some a bit more, with some a bit less. When we got a bit bigger, they are also a bit more willing. But
So also, I think one of the opponents, you know, at the time that you guys as well started, I mean, Uber model was being copied around a lot. Companies like Batmaid and you'd mentioned HomeJoy were coming up too. How did this affect your business?
Mm-hmm. So there were a lot. So this Uber for X area where startups were searching for applying the business model of Uber for other fields. Mm-hmm. So there was HomeJoy that you mentioned. It was there was Book a Tiger, which was funded by TX Group. There was Helpling, which was the Rocket Internet copycat. And there was Batmaid, who kind of copied the front end from HomeJoy and the mm-hmm. back end legal system from us. And HomeJoy was really a classic Silicon Valley success, as it looked like. They came out of Y Combinator. Mm-hmm. They got funding by Google Ventures and Andreessen Horowitz. Then we saw Uber coming to London. 2 months later, they were coming to Berlin. So we were a bit afraid. But another 2 months later, they were gone again and closed down and gave back the money they had left to their investors, because mainly out of two reasons. So one, it was just clear that what they're doing is illegal. So they're supporting black work. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Uber, it was a bit more of a gray zone because they started out with these black cab drivers, which were historically really rather self-employed people with their own business cards and so on. Whereas with cleaning, if you tell somebody, go clean there tomorrow for this salary at this quality, this many rooms, it's clearly who is the employer. Mm-hmm. And second, it's just not that easy to manage the workforce. You cannot just put the app in the app store and then employees will say, oh yeah, tomorrow at that time for that salary, I will be on time and clean exactly to the level how that customer wants it. And then I'll wait another days or hours until the next job pops up. It's just not that easy. So in the long run, it was really good for us because it brought us customers. So we ask all our customers where they come from. Mm-hmm. And it's very diverse. So it's not, some did it unregistered, some did registration themselves. Sometimes it's first time employment, but also a lot of them come from a cleaning institution. Mm-hmm. Because they realize maybe in the short term a cleaning company makes sense, but on the long run, if you employ somebody for a year, it just makes sense if you pay 10 francs less and the employee earns 50% more.
Okay. And the first time Quit raised funds in exchange for equity was back in 2012. So what did the Swiss fundraising scene look like back then for startups?
So quite different. So even the word startup wasn't that known. So when I told people I work for a startup, then they didn't know what I'm doing. So I often said, yeah, I have my own company. Yeah. But then they maybe a bit exaggerated, but they thought about the factory with people and trucks going in and out. So if you're just two guys without any salary in a small room in Technopark, that's a bit exaggeration. But if you said I'm working on a project, then the next question was, yeah, what do you do for real? Like, are you still studying? Do you have a job next to it? And you're like, no, that's all I do. And maybe if you've been working on it full time since 2 years, the word project is an understatement. So yeah. I'm happy now we have the word startup that covers a very, very broad spectrum, but everybody understands it. And just to give a bit general perspective on how known startups and startup investing was back then. But we did a round and we did it how we learned it there, which was like classical financial modeling in the way that, okay, in the beginning, you need some money to invest and you won't make that much money. So you need some external capital to cover that bridge. And then you reach the break-even point and that's it. And this is how we planned for. And it actually did work out. So we only raised 600,000 back then from Lucius Meisser, who was the founder of Wallo, a peer-to-peer online storage, and Thomas Dübendorfer, who then later founded SickTick, Lucius Meisser and Paul Sevinch, the founder of Doodle, and Mark Sonmeier, the CEO of Jobs.ch. So there were already like these first mover business angels. But I remember that one investor said, you know, there are these investors that already in the back of their head planned with a second round. So the really clever ones know that you might need more money. And now that's the complete standard for startups that you plan with pre-seed, seed, A, B, C, and, hardly think about that there might be other, options as well.
So during our prep call, you mentioned that a lot of startup founders get into the VC game not really knowing what they're getting into. So what did you mean by that?
Yeah, good bridge. Exactly that, with that there might be other options. So over the time, I've seen a lot of startups fail. Also, a lot of startups that were really hyped a lot and were all the hype. For example, back then, maybe some listeners remember it, and there was Poken. It was like a USB-C stick that you could touch each other and then you exchange it the contact information. And that was like all the hype and everybody said, look, like these guys, how they are doing it. And somehow I never heard of it and they're gone. And I mean, there are so many cases, and also those that might sound like a wonderful exit, behind the curtain, the story might look a little bit different. And a lot of young founders are like, don't even see a other way than just going the classic way of raising seed A, B, C. And so in the whole news, I think there's a strong survivorship bias. And this you see also in founders. A lot of founders, they just want to race the classic way. Then they think, yeah, you get a high valuation and then you get the bus and then you're a success. But it's not how that works. And to the more experienced people you talk to, for example, also Equit, so our CEO, Marie-Christine, she went through an IPO with Windelnde and Armand Margarian, our CTO. He was on board with Full Tilt Poker when poker was really going through the roof and moved from Silicon Valley to Dublin with the whole company. Those people are really more cautious about getting into that VC game. Right. They're totally not against it, but they are aware of the metrics that you get into. And those are that you only have one startup and the VC has a portfolio of like 40 startups. If your startup fails, then that's all you have. For the VC, it doesn't care because they have multiple ones. It's okay if, if even most of them fail, if some are really going through the roof. And that's the thing. They really want growth at basically any cost. And once you get in that game of buying growth with external funding, it's almost impossible to get out. So you need the growth and you need to continue with the growth. And therefore, you need to get more and more funding. And if not, things aren't that easy. So if you do not want to raise more money because it maybe totally makes sense, on one hand, you would have to let go of a lot of people. On the other hand, you would have to tell your investors that you don't want to raise another round, which they don't want. They'd rather see you close down or take even more risk and grow. So they will not accept it most often. And for you, your valuation will come down because you'll have less growth. So in the end, nobody's happy. And that's a really not good spirit in the whole company, as you can imagine. And the thing is, if you get into it, you're in it and you don't get out of it. And I think that's nothing bad if you know the game you're playing. But I think more founders should be aware what they're getting into. And maybe there are other options. Like blowing in a classic way, really crazy idea of making more money than you spend, for example.
So what advice would you give people who are then going in for raising funds?
The rules of the game and go into it with either not taking it too seriously and just playing along and being just aware on what they're getting into and the metrics. Or otherwise... look at different options.
Okay. So last year you decided to make 100,000 Quid shares publicly tradable on Aktionariat. What motivated this decision?
Lucius Meisser did, one of our main shareholders and founder of Aktionariat. No, but I really like the idea. So I like the idea of democratization of small cap companies. And we did it rather for not to raise money, but rather for the community building aspect of it. So we only communicated the offer to customers and our employees. And as an example, we always had an employee participation plan, but hardly anybody took advantage of it. But once we were on Aktionariat, all you had to say is like download the app and click buy, and then you directly see the value of it. You see Swiss francs, how much value this has. And then once we started this, like already at lunchtime, everybody had shares and everybody. So now everybody in the company, including the Lernende, has shares. And it makes it way more tangible because it's true that a lot of people don't really get stocks and, and it's very abstract for them. And that's true because they say like, yeah, you tell me it has that value, but where can I sell it?
It's not publicly tradable. They don't know, right? You'd have to, until you exit or whatever.
And it's really, you'd have to send an email to the CFO saying, hey, I want to sell. He might send a mail to all existing shareholders who wants to buy. And then you do a contract and 4 months later, you sold these shares. And like this, you just have an app and can click buy. Or sell, and you see the the value in Swiss francs. So I think it's an amazing tool.
So to date, Quid has over 20,000 customers with around 40,000 employment contracts and a settled payroll of almost 300 million francs in Switzerland. And as you mentioned, you also expanded to Germany. So what's next for Quid?
We should update these numbers. I think now it's accumulated over 30,000 customers, but that's not active.
Okay.
Customers, but we'll clear this year probably over 80 million. So what's next? First, Quid Business. So we started this year, mm-hmm. and B2B needs longer sales cycles. Our target group is luckily quite defined, but not that easy to reach, especially because there are a lot of players and established structures in the market. On advertising to startups. So there's a lot to do there. Then also Germany, it's looking really good. We just extended the team over these 2 months from 2 to 6 people. But still, it's a 10 times bigger market than Switzerland, at least inhabitants-wise. So yeah, there's also a lot to do there. But we are looking at the next country, and that's the UK.
All right. And what's next for you, David?
For me personally, it was funny when I read through the questions and I thought about my trip around the world. I realized that this was at the time when I turned 30. Yeah. And I thought, why not do that again 10 years later when you're turning 40, which isn't yet the case, but a couple of years, and maybe repeat that every 10 years. So it was an inspiration for maybe a new rule that I'll stick to through my life.
I mean, going on that, like, what was maybe one thing or a couple of things up to you that was really like eye-opening, that changed your life, that you learned during your travels?
A lot of things, but
yeah, I would.
I mean, what is life about? I don't know. But it definitely makes you feel alive, the things you live through there on such a trip. And they're really different characteristics of different parts of the trip. So with the motorbike, you're totally remote places. That's something different as other places. And I do like the serious life, you know, to have a regular life, to use your brain, to be really effective and produce a lot of intelligent stuff. But I think it's still, you need to balance those mm-hmm. two. So when you travel a long time, then I was really looking forward to have a regular life and a clear mind and work a lot, basically. And on the other hand, if you work another, let's say, 9 years, you work a lot, then it's I think a good idea to also take 1 year off and not work.
And what would be some recommendations you would like to give to our listeners in terms of any podcasts, books, or other resources or gadgets that you really like or has helped you a lot?
I think the most standard things are already mentioned here, but I can mention some podcasts. One is T-Boy, the best one yet. It's like a really high energetic, short-term daily business news. Mm-hmm. Then The Pitch, it's another podcast that is like Shark Tank, but really uncut and raw without the show. And speaking of those two, I think the first season, at least, of the podcast called The Startup by Gimlet, which is from the guy while he built up Gimlet. And funny, the funny thing is, so while during the podcast, the show The Pitch is actually bought by Gimlet, and then Gimlet gets bought by Spotify, which also bought T-Boy. Now T-Boy and The Pitch are on its own again. But it was funny to listen to all those and see the connections and how lively that market is.
All right. Thank you for sharing. We'll add this to our description so the listeners can check it out for themselves. So now it brings us to the last segment of this episode, which is the rapid fire questions. So are you ready?
I'm ready. Try to not answer them relatively.
All right. VC or angel money?
Angel.
How many times have you regretted your decisions during your startup career?
Zero.
Do you want Quit to outgrow you?
Yes.
Describe the benefits that Quit brings to the table in one word.
Convenience.
All right. Well, that's it. Very good. You're probably the one who answered the fastest out of all our guests.
It was hard. My brain had more to say, but...
that's good. Well, thank you so much, David, today for all the knowledge and information you've shared with us. I'm sure our listeners will really enjoy listening to this episode.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for listening.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.